From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 5 years ago when Donald Trump was spending a lot of time calling for the pullout of all American troops from Afghanistan. He called nation building a waste and said that we had lost too many lives to continue. During the presidential campaign, Trump shifted just a bit, and as president, he has recommitted, essentially, to the long haul in Afghanistan. Just a few days ago, 22 people were killed when a bomb blew up at a political rally in Afghanistan. There's a presidential election scheduled for next year in that country. Is it stable enough to hold elections and trust its leadership? What have we accomplished with our nation building there? Dr. Bharat Gopalaswamy is the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council in Washington. He's worked for years on Asian policy and affairs. He's well-positioned to evaluate the Trump administration's work in that part of the world. Gopalaswamy has written that the Trump administration's South Asia policy is dominated by Afghanistan, but it also ought to include India and other possible partners or foes in that region. Dr. Gopalaswamy is in Rochester today as a guest of the Rochester chapter of the World Affairs Council, and he's here with us on Connections. Just got off a plane, and we're thrilled to have you. Thanks for taking the time to come into the studio here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And before we get to that conversation, a brief hello from our news director, Randy Gortman, on day two of our fall membership campaign. Hello, Randy.
Hi, Evan. Again, great programming. If you listened to last hour, really interesting update on what's going on at the Port of Charlotte in Rochester. But I know Connections likes to go local and around the world and talking about foreign policy. It's the kind of discussion that you will not hear, believe me, on many other local shows in this region. But we do need your support. We only do this a few times a year. If you could call in your pledge or do it online, it would be very helpful. It is being matched. You're getting more bang for your buck matching your pledges this hour. Dr. Eric Dreyfus of Brighton. He's been a member since 1973. Not an uncommon story. A lot of people very loyal to WXXI, not just out of loyalty, Evan, but I think because of the kind of programming that we bring on a regular basis. Phone number is 1-800-295-9994, 1-800-295-9994, or you can do it online at wxxinews.org or weos.org, and we hope you will continue to support the kinds of programming you listen to every day, like Connections.
All right. Thank you very much, okay. Randy. Want to let you know that Dr. Gopalaswamy is here as a guest of the World Affairs Council of Rochester, and most of their events that they have, by the time their guests are here, they are sold out. But if you want to learn more about what the council does and who they bring in on an annual basis, you can contact the person who's at the head of it. It's Bob Gerace, and you can email him. That is rgerace1 at rochester.rr.com. And that's why Dr. Gopalaswamy is here. And I want to start with Afghanistan because you did write, I think, in the summer of 2017, a few months into the Trump administration, that they, understandably so, their South Asian policy was dominated by Afghanistan. That's no surprise. What was interesting was seeing the president's shift over the years on nation building, on our commitment to Afghanistan long term. And you said in a recent interview that he seems to, whether he wanted to or not, sort of defer to the establishment. And the establishment is kind of you, isn't it? You're kind of part of the establishment, aren't you?
Yeah, I'd like to jokingly say we're the swamp.
Oh, well, you're the swamp.
But we're not.
You're not the swamp.
We're on the nonprofit side, and we're not the swamp. But essentially, the bigger question or the bigger thing is, you know, there was an establishment inertia that was holding him back on this. And I think for the right reasons and the logic essentially was, the argument goes, you know, many people, and you see the doom and gloom in Afghanistan, the stories that dominate the headlines are the bomb kind of stories, and we're not making progress. And on the security situation, the situation is very fragile. The Afghanistan government is corrupt. And all these have validity. But what you're missing are the success stories in Afghanistan that the United States has been able to achieve so far. You have a quasi-functioning economy. You have a political system. You have the Afghan National Security Force, however weak they may be. But there is an institutionalization of such a force, and the United States helping that force achieve its mission. And you have, as you know, you're even looking forward to an election, although however contentious that may be. You know, we've achieved, the United States has been able to put all these mechanisms in the last 17 years. And in the scheme of things, 17 years is a very small window of time. And with all the underminings with the United States as adversaries in the form of Pakistan, Russia, and Iran. So with all these headwinds against us, we've been able to come so far. I think one of the greatest success stories at the Atlantic Council, we hosted and we wanted to project that, was the Afghanistan girls' robotics team that won first prize in a robotics competition a few months ago in D.C. Roya Mahboob is one of the premier Afghanistan female IT entrepreneur and was rated in the Times magazine as one of the most influential women in the world. The deputy chief of mission today in the Afghanistan embassy is a woman. And the incoming ambassador is the current Afghanistan, the incoming ambassador to the United States is the current ambassador of Afghanistan to Indonesia. So can you ever think of in the Taliban days, Afghan mission in Washington will be the, where the number one and number two will be represented by women and women leadership when we have this whole, women's empowerment movement. Afghanistan has come so far to project all these success stories in the 20 years. And who is responsible behind all this? We, the United States. And we should, you know, that's why I think I'm convinced that we've been able to achieve great things. We should be proud of it. And we should see through some of these achievements.
Yeah, and what I want to do is kind of push a little and ask you to respond to critics of nation building, to at least outline for them who are skeptical of nation building. Is there, I assume you don't view nation building as sort of a blank check, that we ought to be there forever, that there's no standards in which we ought to stop that kind of a mission. Because what you're outlining is progress, but fragile progress, the kind of progress that without our support, our infrastructure, our presence could go away. But is there a point at which you might say, this is not working anymore, this is not worth, or this is not worth the cost in lives? And
I think the critics also have a point that we cannot sign a blank check. Essentially, we are not about giving blank checks, and America is not in a position that it once used to be to give blank checks to nations like Afghanistan. And I think there is also a responsibility on our side to make sure that the Afghanistan, the people of Afghanistan and the Afghanistan establishment, so to speak, respects what we give, and they make incremental progress. They have to get their act in together, the political class. We're not in the, I'm not going to debate Afghanistan local politics here, but the political class needs to get their act together and move forward on some of the progress that they have promised us to get things in order. We can support them only that much. But they also need to understand this. And I think there is a fair amount of understanding among some of those political elites to get to where they need to get their country on stable footing. So I think we need to see progress on those things. And that's where the frustration for many of the critics on the Afghanistan policy stems from. And to arrest those criticisms, we need to see some of those movement. And I think the dark horse here is Pakistan, which has continuously affected our progress in Afghanistan on the security situation. And part of why we support the Trump strategy, or I think it's in the right direction, is it calls for a harder action on Pakistan. And it defines the U.S.-Pakistan relationship at some levels on the prism of Afghanistan. And that's where I think we ought to see, we're hoping to see progress in Pakistan.
I'm going to come back to Pakistan in just a second, but why don't you remind our listeners who may be wondering, as you say, with some female leadership and some progress being made in remarkable ways in Afghanistan that we never would have seen under Taliban domination. What is the state of the Taliban? Reports that Mullah Omar died in a Pakistani hospital 5 years ago. And, you know, what do we know about the state of, and strength of the Taliban?
I think the Taliban, you know, the Obama administration's mistake was we gave a time-based approach for our exit in Afghanistan, and that's been the fundamental criticism. And Taliban went into hiding, they knew that they had to wait just a few years to wait the United States out, and they could come back. I think the Taliban are disparate networks. There are networks of Taliban. There are safe havens inside Pakistan that have been harboring these Talibans, and there is a robust supply of money and infrastructure to the Taliban that have equipped them to launch their offensive against the Afghan population. And I think the problem in arresting the Taliban, as you rightly pointed out, Mullah Omar died in a Pakistani hospital 5 years ago. Osama bin Laden was found in close to Rawalpindi. So that's where we need to arrest. We are having frank conversations. We are having painful conversations, as well as difficult conversations with the Pakistanis to say, listen, you know, we know part of the problem lies here. Let's find a way to work together, because the Pakistanis always consistently argue that they've also been a victim of terrorism from the 2014. That's when it hit them home, and there was a bombing where the school children, killing of so many school children. So I think there is a recognition, and there is a new leadership in Pakistan that provides us the opportunities to confront these problems together.
You wrote, though, in a recent article that the American president is inconsistent and sort of unpredictable and may say things in a moment that make you pull your hair out, but then the next day shift. And let me just read a little bit about some of that, and I want to get your take on that. You write that New Delhi hasn't forgotten a phone call between Trump and Nawaz Sharif, calling him a fantastic leader of a fantastic country, but is quick to replace that memory with a more recent snub to Sharif in Saudi Arabia a few weeks ago, where Trump referred to India and not to Pakistan as a victim of radical terror, end quote. Is there enough consistency, and frankly, is there enough sort of intelligence on the part of this president to feel like he can send a consistent message that you would trust right now?
Look, Trump's consistency in inconsistency, so to speak, has not only been on the India-Pakistan issue; it's been uniform in a number of issues, right? But I think overall there is a recognition and an understanding in the U.S. administration and the establishment, and I'm sure that gets to the president about the values of these various countries that offer to the United States. Trump, the phone call, we reported the phone call, but early January 1st this year, there was a tweet. The New Year's gift to the Pakistanis was a tweet from the president early in the morning saying that Pakistan has taken billions of dollars from the United States and fooled, and in return, all we've got is lies and deceit and nothing. So that summarizes the mood of many officials that have dealt with Pakistan over the years.
So is it a case right now where the foreign policy establishment or where foreign governments are trying to ignore what our actual president says and dealing more with his emissaries, other government leaders, the State Department, et cetera?
I think they try to deal with it. See, because at a working level, you know, today Secretary Pompeo is in Riyadh or was in Riyadh meeting with King. At a working level, they know it's Secretary Pompeo, Secretary Mattis, and these are the officials that they have to deal with. But the president is the president at the end of the day, and you need to engage the president. And you need to, you know, it does not mean that the president does not have a voice or a tweet. More importantly, a tweeting handle. So they need to manage. They need to work with the president as well. So what is missing in all these things is you would normally have assistant secretaries and deputy assistant secretaries and ambassadors doing these jobs at a functional and a day-to-day and an operational level. And that's what's missing for many of these foreign governments and establishments. Yesterday, you must have seen a report from the Chinese ambassador to the U.S. saying that we don't know who to deal with. And that's a pretty telling statement. I don't know if that is a politically manipulated statement with the current relations with China. But you need these people to deal with. And what happens is at many times, the bureaucracy and these people are often interpreters and translators of the United States message from a political level to an operational level. And when that is missing, that causes uncertainty and at times chaos. And Trump's inconsistency adds to that chaos and uncertainty because we're confused about what our policy is.
Sure. And some of the frustration in the first full year of the Trump administration was a lack of filled posts. For example, an ambassador to India as recently, I don't know when many of these posts were filled, but you wrote in July of 2017 that with that post still unfilled, it felt at the very least a bit of a snub to take that country and that position seriously. Have we seen much movement on
that? Yeah, I mean, the region that I deal with, David Hale, who was the ambassador to Pakistan, has now become the undersecretary for political affairs. In the Tillerson era in the State Department, it was pretty, I think the morale was low. The positions were largely unfilled. And more importantly, I understand that the effort made was pretty minimal or largely in the wrong direction to fill these positions. But I understand now Tillerson, Secretary Pompeo, is working twice as hard to fill these unfilled positions. We're seeing some of these nominations go forward. We're seeing confirmation of these nominations. Still, that does not, it is nowhere where we should be. And this is pretty 2 years into an administration. And many, I think, including in Saudi Arabia, if my understanding serves correct today, Saudi Arabia is one of our principal allies in the Middle East. I don't think we have an ambassador in Saudi Arabia.
How can that be?
Call it what you may. Call it
apathy?
Incompetence, apathy, or, you know, lack of, I would blame it on, you know, it's like you're playing catch up. Before you come into an administration, you have marked, you have a map of these are the postings and these are the right candidates and we need to interview them and there needs to be a structure. And I think once that structure is destroyed, or we didn't have the, like, you know, it has to do with the broader, look at the whole Trump campaign officials who are currently under probe or investigation. So these would be normally the team that would be interviewing, vetting candidates, securing them for the jobs that they need to be secured, and then put them in the positions. So now once that's a whole infrastructure is gone, I think it's just you're playing catch up.
Well, you mentioned David Hale, new Undersecretary of State. And that was brought up. I had a conversation on Sunday with James Zogby, who is the president of the Arab American Institute. And he pointed to Mr. Hale saying that, you know, there are critics of the Trump administration who say things like, well, how could any good people work for this administration, given what he represents? And Zogby was saying, there are moments where you are really grateful to have smart, qualified, experienced people at the helm in certain parts of the world. And he thought that was one example. Do you feel the same way? What would you say to critics who say, well, I don't care how seasoned and experienced you are, how could you work for that administration? Are you someone who roots for the really qualified, seasoned people to stay, to do the work?
Because the United States is so embedded in the global system. An abdication of American leadership is dangerous. And so on that line, I think there are people that we need to do these jobs. Otherwise, every day that we are not there in some part of the world or there is nobody to answer a phone call, there are lives being lost. So where, you know, the moral argument aside, there is a responsibility. There are lives. We've constructed this world order after 1945, and we are largely responsible for some of these lives being protected. And I think that's where, no matter inexperienced or qualified, America has always, you know, for all the failings that we've had in the world and all our flawed policies and somewhere, America is always in some form a trusted, honest, neutral broker. And people look to us as that preserver of, guarantor of security and stability in many parts of the world. And when you answer that phone call, it gives a hope of, it gives a sign of hope to the person on the other side, whether we can solve this problem or not. But the first step is to give that hope. And I think that's where we need these people in the places that we ought to have.
And so now on the subject of security, I want to return the focus to Afghanistan and ask you what you think the worst case scenario would be. If the critics of nation building got their way and we really exited, what could happen?
Look, that's a great question, right? It's like what we know what success looks like in Afghanistan or what success could look like. We have an idea. But can you tell me what failure in Afghanistan looks like? Are we going back to the Taliban days? Are we going go back to worse than the Taliban days? Or are we? Is it going to be a safe breeding ground for all these ISIS and all these terrorist groups? And you know, it's going to be largely ungoverned space that is home to bed of all the activities that would be detrimental that could be detrimental to our European allies and some part of our Asian allies as well. So. The question to ask is, what does failure in Afghanistan look like? What are the scenarios and what are the implications for the United States for that kind of scenario?
How much confidence do you have in upcoming elections in Afghanistan?
sitting where I'm sitting and looking at the way things are going, I think there is a lot of work to do, and we are way behind that work. And I think there is an incompetence that's been reflected from the President Ghani's government as well to getting these things together. But that said, I also know the people that personally that work with President Ghani, including President Ghani himself. He was on the board of the Atlantic Council. And their heart is in the right place. And I know they are working sincerely very hard to get these elections on track, as well as the United States government is keen and sincere and wants to make sure that this election succeeds.
We, off the top of the show, mentioned another bombing was in Kabul, I think, and 22 people killed at a political rally. The candidate was not there, not injured, but I think you mentioned before the program that if that's not every day, it's far too common that we see these kind of violent attacks in the political process still, yes?
Correct. But these violent attacks in the political process are deliberate to sabotage us from winning in Afghanistan. And I think that's where we ought to not get deterred by this these bombings and move forward with what we would see as credible and fair elections.
What are the possible outcomes when it comes to elections that would be in sort of the dangerous or negative category? And I'm thinking fraud, corruption, apart from violence. Obviously, violence, widespread violence, lack of participation is a big possible problem. But if we can get some level of participation that we feel good about, can we also trust the process that it is not corrupt, that it is open enough, that the results can be verified?
Certainly in the past, we've done that in the past. You know, there have been accusations that where we have favored one candidate or the other candidate, and I think we need to be careful about it, and that we need to maintain the integrity of that elections. And I think that is critical and key, especially in the context of where we have issues with our own elections and elections across democracies in the world, in France or wherever, India or somewhere, about the unwanted election interference or meddling in external interference and meddling in election. When we are constructing Afghanistan society and we are looking at the political process so closely, as well as the electoral process closely, we need to take into account all these kinds of issues.
How often should we be trying to, I don't know if the term putting our thumb on the scale is too, is over the top. I'm wondering how often we should be looking at possible candidates or possible leaders and trying to affect the outcome because we have a sense for that one outcome would be preferable. What sort of is the line for American intervention or involvement? I don't think interference in an election, but supporting candidates over another.
Look, at the end of the day, we are going to, I think, who pays for the election? We're going to have to pay for that election. So there is going to be that part of that involvement so far in the election. And I think wherever capacity is needed, we need to build that capacity for the whole electoral process as well. And I think that's where we ought to limit or restrict our involvement with their election in terms of building capacity, in terms of monitoring, in terms of helping them secure their electoral process, as well as protect the political legitimacy of the whole electoral process. Backing one candidate or the other would be amount to interfering with the sovereignty of the country. And I don't think we want to get ourselves into that kind of a mix.
You also mentioned that if nation building fails or if we leave Afghanistan, it is vulnerable. And it doesn't just impact Afghan society. There are possible impacts in the region and around the world. And this is something else that Jim Zogby was talking about on Sunday. He said that if you go back to 2003, the State Department had entire reports warning against what happens if we destabilize Iraq. That contrary to what some of the lay opinions were, that just the factions alone were going to prevent any sort of greeting us as liberators and all of the silly things that we heard about that. We ignore that essentially. And Iran benefits. And there are sort of a domino effect on the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iran and who's emboldened and what do they do in response. Is that the same kind of warning that you have for those who might leave Afghanistan vulnerable?
Yeah. And I think, it becomes a playground for the Russians, the Iranians. And it's not in the Russian and the Iranian interest for the Afghans to fail too. in the sense, you know, their destabilizing effects will have spillover effects in the border areas for Iran and for the Central Asian states for the Russians, which I'm sure they would not want to. What the Russian and the Iranian interests vis-a-vis Afghanistan against us is they would want us to, they'd want to keep the pot boiling only to that level that will keep us sucked in with these kinds of bomb blasts, but not come in a big way to get themselves sucked into the process.
In a moment after our only break, I want to talk more about the relationship of the United States and India mm-hmm. and how we see that relationship, economic relationship, and more. But one more question before our break here. I'm looking at a headline from The New Yorker and John Cassidy writing a piece saying that that what we've heard from this administration in regards to the questions about Jamal Khashoggi takes us closer to, quote, a post-truth world, one step closer. So what John Cassidy writes today, because you mentioned that Secretary Pompeo in Riyadh and what the secretary and others have said is a little different than what President Trump has said in interviews. He has speculated about rogue killers and really sort of speculative, wild, unconfirmed things. And John Cassidy writes that the world of post-truth is one step closer if Trump gets away with promoting another risible theory. And I want to ask you if you agree with that and if that is dangerous ultimately, whether it is in this situation with Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia, whether it's questions on India, Pakistan, or others. If we are not challenging sort of obviously intellectually bankrupt or wild speculation, is the world becoming a more dangerous place?
Yeah, I think because you see, as I at somewhere I referred to this statement that I made that the world still considers the United States as a relatively honest, neutral broker, and as a guarantor of peace and stability. And now, and the basis for that was, at some level, we were able to being trusted entity. And what Cassidy refers to is some of this trust comes from us being intellectually honest, transparent, and relatively accurate in most of the situations wherever we can. And if we were inaccurate, it was because of our intelligence failures or whatsoever. It was not deliberate. So now if that's taken out of the equation, then what is left? So that's where you come at issues like whether we are morally bankrupt or intellectually bankrupt, or we are looking to, let things slide and not challenge some of these assumptions or autocratic rulers.
But some analysts have said, look, the world community is going to understand that if they are uncomfortable dealing with the United States as an honest broker right now, this is one administration. It may last 4 years. It may last eight. And there will be sort of a pause in relationship. It won't be irreparably harmed. Do you see
now,
it that way?
I disagree with that, because if you've been able to do this now, you've set a precedent to do this again. And if I'm a ruler on the other side, and I'm looking at saying America could do this, what's the guarantee that America will not be able to do this again? Under a different leadership. For example, take this whole movement in case of nuclear disarmament, right? So we were promoting Global Zero and Obama's disarmament speech and everything. And, you know, you had a momentum towards nuclear disarmament. And now a ruler comes and says, hey, listen, I'll threaten you with fire and fury. Next day I fall in love with you. And if I'm somewhere in some part of the world saying, why would I give up my nukes because somebody might just threaten me with fire and fury again? And perhaps he loves me because I did not give up my nukes, and he could not threaten me with, he could not go ahead with his promise, and now he wants to love me and find a way to seduce me to give up my nukes. So when you have this kind of inconsistency, the wide-ranging spectrum of inconsistency, I think that's where the problem comes at.
So there's a real risk to future relationships based on this administration, even if everyone in regards to the Trump administration is gone. There's a real risk.
There is a risk, yeah.
How close are we to severing or losing some of those relationships?
We're so much embedded in the system. We're so much wanted in the world. I think there is going to be a lot of open wounds that we need to put some ointment on. So that's where I'll leave it.
Okay. Let's get our only break of the hour. And we're going to come back with Dr. Bharat Gopalaswamy, the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council in Washington. Just got into Rochester this afternoon. He's a guest here of the World Affairs Council of Rochester, making a presentation tonight, but kind enough to join us for this hour right here on Connections. Back with him next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the next Connections, a conversation about what's going on regarding charges brought by the FBI against Assemblyman Joe Arrigo, charges of bribery, but confusion about who else might have been involved. Reporter Gary Craig from the Democrat and Chronicle has worked with his colleagues to break that story open, and it could be connected to other recent developments and allegations. We're going to talk about that web of stories Wednesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Hello again to our news director, Randy Gorman, coming over from across the hall at the WXXI newsroom.
And glad to do it again, Evan. We only, again, do this a few times a year, but it is so great to hear the kind of intelligent discussion that you hear every day, and you really never know what to expect. Again, last hour, we talked about Charlotte development up here in Rochester. This hour, talking about policy in South Asia and really important topics, ones that we know a lot of WXXI listeners are interested in. You can tell by the social media responses we get and the calls to the talk show. But to continue that, we do need your support. If you could do whatever you can to become either a member or add to your current membership, you can call us now at 1-800-295-9994, 1-800-295-9994, or you can go online, wxxinews.org or weos.org. And this hour, Dr. Eric Dreyfus of Brighton, a member since 1973, is matching your pledge. And again, that gives you a lot more bang for the buck and what you can do for, it's not for us specifically here as much as it is for the community. This really is truly a community institution, community media center. And these days, you do want to get the kinds of news and information you can trust. It's right here. Do what you can now, 1-800-295-9994 or online at wxxinews.org.
All right. Thank you very much, Randy. Dr. Bharat Gopalaswamy is the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council in Washington. We've talked a lot about Afghanistan and related policy. I want to talk about a small nation named India. And the president and Narendra Modi occasionally get some comparisons. They're both populists, that they had some similarities. I think that you didn't see the similarities extending as far as others. How much do you see Trump and Modi similar at all?
Well, on a lighter note, I think at some levels, Make America Great Again was made in India.
You mean? Okay.
Both of them were, you know, took to social media. Yeah. Both of them wanted to connect with people directly. Both of them had protectionist inclinations. Mm-hmm. Both of them were populists. You know, all these kinds of, and strong leaders, the strong men boasting about 56-inch or 65-inch chest and all that stuff, muscular reaction to Pakistan. And then when you see Modi going to, you know, vis-a-vis Pakistan policy has been like a consistency and inconsistency again. So all these put together, I think they're aware we saw the similarities, although there are a little bit of differences because Modi did not come with a family into the prime minister's office, contrary to what President Trump has, and he had no family. And, you know, he had put all these appointments and there were, you know, there were he showed greater inclination towards governance than Trump did. So that, you know, I wouldn't make that comparison, but there are, I think there are broad contours of their all appealing to the masses in a different way.
How do you view our economic policy? I think you wrote in June of 2017 that the campaign rhetoric from this administration on trade practices have already been forgotten. So how do you view the Trump administration vis-a-vis trade and in particular with India?
I think the trade is one of the most contentious issues vis-a-vis India. There are three main issues. I think the U.S.-India relationship is, I want to calibrate the U.S.-India relationship from 1998. In 1998, India was a sanctioned country after it went nuclear vis-a-vis the United States. From what it has been a sanctioned country to it's been, you know, whatever you want to call it, allies, friends, or friends without allies. I call it friends with benefits, the U.S.-India relationships. It has come thus far, but we are entering into a very different, very interesting times because of three main issues. One is the trade issue that you mentioned. That's going to be contentious. We need to get a trade deal with India. And I, as I understand, these are some of the most difficult, painful conversation. And it's not restricted to Trump alone. This was in the Obama years. This was in the previous years. It's just It's just completely different societies and different philosophies. So clinching a trade deal is going to be one of the toughest and most sought after prize, if for lack of a better way to put it. The next issue is, if you notice, India's bought an anti-aircraft system in the form of S-400 from Russia last week or 10 days ago. So, and the United States has this legislation, the Countering Adversaries through Sanctions Act, and whether India gets a waiver or not, because 70% of India's military hardware is not even Russian, it's from the Soviet Union. And now United States is surpassing many of these arms suppliers, one of the largest arms suppliers to India, but this, some of these things stand in the way. How do you reconcile this? The third issue is Iran. India and Iran have civilizational relationships. You know, at some levels, the language of the Indian Mughal courts was Persian, so the relationship stretches that far. So with Iran, and the United States' policy towards Iran has been pretty hostile, and, you know, recognizing Iran as a principal sponsor of terrorism in the Middle East. So how you reconcile these three issues are going to be interesting in the next 2 to 3 years.
How do you view Trump as a campaigning protectionist? I don't know that he ever called himself a protectionist, but in many ways, I think the proposed policies were pretty protectionist. And in practice, do you see him that way?
I think in some sense, he's been pragmatic. He's been a deal cutter vis-a-vis the Indians have been. And I think he does see, he realizes the limitations of some of these. Some of the campaign rhetoric that he, for example, when it came to the NATO alliance, yes, he raises money, but, you know, he's walked back from saying it's not a obsolete alliance anymore and they're important members and stuff. And vis-a-vis the Indians also, I think he pushes hard. But the trade deficit with India is really not much. It's $20 billion, $20, $25 billion compared to what, you know, what the United States has with China.
Several hundred billion.
The India is in perspective. So I don't think there is really that much to wriggle around vis-a-vis the India. And I think if there was an opportunity for a deal cutting in any of these issues, he would make those accommodations.
All right. So I want to ask you a little bit about disarmament then, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure.
And this is an area that we try to do a lot of homework on this program, but I'm a lot less familiar with your views and work and writing on this particular issue. So let me just kind of ask you for a broad take on the work that you've seen on disarmament pre-Trump administration. You referenced the Obama administration and some of their approach to it there, whether it has been successful or not, and then how you see sort of the current climate.
You know, I used to, when I was at Cornell, I worked on international security. I worked in the peace studies program looking at nuclear weapons. Then I went to Stockholm with the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute looking at arms control and disarmament issues. And I think primarily arms control and disarmament have lost their momentum.
They've lost momentum.
And you know, for, as I would say, for some of the right reasons as well, because I think the non-proliferation treaty was a flawed treaty to begin with. It divided the haves and the have-nots. And people, countries like India, warned against having this kind of an approach.
Okay, but before we go forward, go back and remind our listeners, non-proliferation treaty happened when?
In 1967.
And the division in haves and haves-nots, you're saying it penalized those who were not nuclear nations.
They were not nuclear nations, and they said, you know, anybody who enters the nuclear club after 1967 would not be permitted inside the non-proliferation.
Yeah.
You know, all those things. And then we had the negotiations on the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty in the mid-90s that looked at banning all nuclear explosions, and then it could not get ratified in the U.S. Senate. So these two, and after that, we've not had any serious negotiation at the multilateral level on, you know, either banning nuclear tests or, sincere effort to give up nuclear weapons. Since then, there have been so many proposals that have been floated around, but none of them have gotten to any fruition because, you know, the place to negotiate all this was in Geneva, and that's where things just took a back seat. And in 90s after, then you had, from 1967, you had 5 nuclear weapon states. Now you have 9 nuclear weapon states. So where, you know, you have advancement in other types of non-nuclear military technologies, which aid in the delivery of the nuclear deployment. So I would say we need to think of new frameworks and new ways, maybe bilateral or regional agreements that addresses the security of these countries, then housing them all in a big multilateral framework where we cannot get any sort of consensus or agreement.
All right, so if you're helping draft new agreements, and it doesn't sound like you're optimistic right now that the world is moving in that direction, is that fair?
Correct. Yeah, I don't think, you know, but I want to, in this context, I can tie this up to South Asia, because the South Asia has a very interesting element. India and Pakistan have something known as a moratorium on missile test notification, that each party notifies the other country 72 hours in advance of a missile test. And this provision is also there in the Hague Code of Conduct that ties the whole world about missile test notification agreements. Now, I don't think the United States and Russia do that to themselves. You know, they do not honor this part of the agreement. Mm-hmm. But India and Pakistan honor this part of the agreement despite not being party to the Hague Code of Conduct. So when these kind of bilateral small mechanisms can work amongst states, because that addresses their core security interests because of an existential threat, why are we not pursuing some of those approaches and paying attention to them more seriously and leave them to decide? We will facilitate and equip them with the right tools when and wherever necessary, but that invitation has to come from them.
What is a realistic hope for a reduction in nuclear stockpiles?
As we stand, I don't see any realistic hope in the next at least 2 to 4 years.
Okay, so let's do this in the immediate term. Fair, you're not seeing any hope at all. But down the road, with different leadership in different nations, 10, 20 years, a generation down the road, what's a realistic
hope? I think a generation down the years where, you know, when people become cognizant, I think there must be enough awareness amongst what the dangers, you know. I think my generation, I have not lived through the Cold War, so to speak. I didn't live through the Cold War. I lived in India. We were not a nuclear weapon state. I didn't have going hiding under bunkers or, you know, those kinds of drills and trainings. And we've forgotten that. But we need to consistently, the dangers are forgotten, but the weapons that cause those dangers are still there. So we need to remind ourselves, you know, that, listen, these weapons are still there. These nukes are still out there, and their potential to cause those damages are lethal and might harm us.
Is there more risk to full elimination of nuclear stockpiles or more risk to having any sort of a stockpile for deterrent purposes, knowing that a weapon could essentially fall into the hands of a bad actor?
I think, you know, I don't believe in this. It could fall into a bad actor, and he might. If there is a weapon, it is going to fall into some actor. And
what is at some point? You mean inevitably?
Inevitably, you know, there is an accidents theory, right? The normal systems, however well designed, will fail at some stage. There is a well developed accidents theory. So you know, you're going to suffer an accident, or sometimes today, what the system you might be, what a good actor might be today in 15, 20 years,
sure,
might become a bad actor. After this is the consistent danger with the Pakistanis that we've had in our conversation, saying we know the Strategic Plans Division is a responsible and professional entity, but that does not mean somebody could turn unprofessional in 15 to 20 years from now.
So isn't the rejoinder to that that we have to pursue full elimination of stockpiles at some point?
Yeah, we do have to pursue that. All I'm saying is right now I don't have the optimism, or there is no momentum on this.
Okay.
But that does not mean we have to give up the cost. This is where, you know, conversations like this had in Rochester and places like these, the movements sometimes have to be grassroots movements.
Sure.
And I'm glad that we're having this conversation.
Sure, because, I mean, certainly in the political sphere, there's a lot of other things to dominate the conversation. But on the scale of possible devastation to the world, I understand climate change, I understand all kinds of other things, but a nuclear weapon going off in a major population center,
yeah,
is going to change the world forever.
Mm-hmm.
And as I raise my son, it's one of my greatest fears that he will grow up in a world where that happens, because all bets are off when that happens.
Right. I mean, it's a, you know, in some sense, it's a low probability event, but a high impact.
Sure. And low probability, but you're the one who just said that the theory of accidents says that eventually it will happen.
Correct. Yeah. At some stage, we've come close to the training tape incident with Norway. You know, you read all these stories all the time where you're always about a button away. You're always about a finger away from pressing the button.
Yeah.
Some of these, so that possibly, the accidental possibility is always there. The bad actor theory is always there. So, and with an increasing stockpile, why are we taking that risk? Why are we allowing ourselves to get that risk?
Did you, during the campaign, did you sort of observe the president not really knowing what the nuclear triad was? Was that a concern for you?
Yeah, and plus the Senate also commissioned last year around this time, about the mental health of the institution that will safeguard the American nukes. So, these are serious issues,
Okay, and so if 2 to 4 years, you don't have a lot of hope to change, but let's talk, a little bit into the future, and you're part of a team putting policy together to really start reducing stockpiles. Who has to act first? What are some of the barriers that will come down, and how do we get there?
Look, I think some of the barriers here are primarily the way that our own politics is. We're such a divided nation today. We're not able to get consensus on any issue very quickly. And I can see this being politicized. If we are not able to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty in 1999, 20 years later, with this kind of political climate, how are we able to forge a consensus on an issue like this about giving nuclear weapons? It's not about even banning testing at an international level. We're talking about giving nukes. And that's where I think my sense of optimism decreases.
Sure. In this country, there is going to inevitably be some sort of political debate that says, well, you're weak if you give up those weapons, that you're jeopardizing this country's safety. My own very amateur observation of President Obama was that he might very well have been someone who was much more interested in an aggressive course of stockpile reduction and all kinds of sort of nebulously more peaceful ideas. But he also had to play this political game of not looking weak, as the first president of color. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of things I think he had to consider that complicated the that is the amateur observation I have. I wonder how you view
it. I think you put it right. And I think the adjective was the aggressive. The adverb was aggressive, sorry. And Obama pursued some of these, and he laid out his vision. It was an ambitious and an aggressive vision that he laid out in his Prague speech. And I think that's where it became politicized. And I think, and then being the recipient of the Nobel Prize, so you had put symbolism before substance. Mm. And we needed to do a lot of work on the substance. We needed to restore our faith in these multilateral institutions that could take the lead to get to where we need to get to. We had to take the leadership role. But simultaneously, we also needed to work with those international institutions to complement our efforts in some of these, to advance in some of these critical areas, and then, work through our own political process.
I got a few minutes left here, so I'll ask you, what worries you most? What is keeping you up at night most, or sort of monopolizing most of your time at work these days?
I think that's our first point, which is the Afghanistan work. And I think the other part that keeps me up at night, and the other problem that we worry about, is which we did not touch at all in this interview, was the whole Indo-Pacific vision. Obama had, in a bureaucratic way, de-hyphenated the Indo-Pakistan issue. In the sense, you had a special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan deal with AFPAC issues, and then you had a person in South and Central Asia deal with the India issue, and then you had an Asia-Pacific policy. What this administration has done, like you said, the South Asia policy is largely an AFPAC policy, but the India policy at many levels is also seen as a part of the Indo-Pacific vision. That's where two-thirds of the humanity lives today. That's the center of global economy in some sense. And we have the big actor that in the form of China that confronts the United States and many of these in that part of the world. And I think that's an area that we need to worry about, and that's an area that has the potential for risks and things going wrong. And that's a strategic issue for the United States.
Well, then leave us in our final minute with what really could go wrong. Give us some exciting things to think about that are on the negative side.
the trade war going in a largely unfavorable direction. Some accidents happening in the South China Sea. China's penchant for microaggression and not knowing where to stop drawing the United States into a conflict that it does not really want to get engaged in. And at the time where we are engaged in Syria, we're engaged in Afghanistan, we're engaged in Russia. And how many battles are we not positioned to fight this fight?
Do you see the trade trade war, I guess, so to speak, already escalating? Is it in a bad place?
No, I don't think it's in a bad place for the United States. Here I would, you know, actually back President Trump in the sense our economy is booming, right? And, you know, China has, in some sense, taken advantage of the trading system that the United States developed in 1945 and 1978 when they opened up. And have confronted us, and have, you know, and have confronted the United States. So I think even, and we have no incentive to negotiate. So I think it's going to escalate.
All right. See, there's for a moment of optimism. Dr. Bharat Gopalaswamy is director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council in Washington. Generous with your time today. Welcome to Rochester. Thanks for being here. He's a guest of the World Affairs Council of Rochester presenting tonight. And I really appreciate your insight and coming on the program today.
It was a pleasure chatting.
Thank you. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack, the producer of Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely afternoon, and we're right back with you tomorrow, day three of the fall membership campaign. Hope you're already a member, because that's what we mean when we say member-supported public radio.